Hello, everybody. Are we all here? We got you all?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you for joining me this evening, everybody. My name is Jackson, and I'll be taking you through this interview with four amazing guests. The Nurse Break is a platform for nurses, midwives working in Australia. We interview in written articles and also on camera like this. So we just chat about a range of interesting topics. If you're watching this live, make sure to post your comments, questions below in the chat as you watch along. Just below, and I will ask them for our guests. And remember, you can always listen to all our previous interviews as well as videos or as podcasts. A bit of a trigger warning for this one tonight. This Q&A may contain discussion that is sometimes confronting and disturbing. Sometimes the words can cause sadness or distress or trigger traumatic memories for people, particularly those of you who are survivors of past abuse, maybe violence or childhood trauma. If you need to talk to somebody, confidential support is available 24/7. For example, the Nurse and Midwife Support Line on 1-800-667-877 or Lifeline on 1-3-1-1-1-4. Today, I'm joined by Jim Snipe. He is a learning disability mental health nurse and a clinical aggression specialist with more than 30 years of experience, I think back in 1989, in a variety of high-risk environments, including mental health, learning disability corrections, and secure units. He's a full-time aggression management researcher, trainer for Alfred Health, a university lecturer in occupational violence and aggression, and a self-defense instructor. Wow. And we got Lita Olson. She was 30 weeks pregnant when an intoxicated and disoriented middle-aged man struck her to the chest as she was carrying out her routine nursing care. Lita is a clinical nurse consultant and has been nursing since 2004 in both the private and public health sector in emergency at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. She's presented in Parliament as a clinical expert in relation to alcohol-fueled violence, amongst so much more. She's currently the clinical lead for the Queensland Occupational Violence Strategy Unit, providing strategic oversight and clinical expertise to the implementation of a range of initiatives to reduce occupational violence. Thanks for joining, Lita. We've got Steph up on the right-hand corner. Stephanie Murphy is a registered nurse, management of clinical aggression educator, and a plastic/trauma clinical nurse specialist at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. She has a grad cert in clinical nursing and recently took part in a travel scholarship to the United States and Canada amongst world specialists in clinical occupational violence to learn about how other countries manage clinical aggression. Thanks for joining, Stephanie. And we've got Trevor Laverick, last but not least. He's a registered nurse with 30 years of experience, primarily in forensic psychiatry and the prison services. He is currently the nurse educator in occupational violence prevention at the Townsville Hospital and Health Service. Over the years, he writes about how he's experienced and observed a cataclysmic rise in the severity of occupational violence that nurses are subjected to. So in his role, he provides theoretical and practical skills to staff to identify, prevent, protect from, and manage behavioural emergencies. So, wow, there we go. I got through all of that. Thanks for joining me, guys. Might start with Lita. I sort of got a question I want to ask all of you is sort of what made you want to become advocates on the issue of aggression and violence, Lita?
Oh, for me, it was very, very natural. I think after my own experience and having to support a number of staff through their own experience as well, it really made me start to think about the way that we view other emergencies compared to behavioural emergencies. And it was, I guess, a great opportunity. I'm a bit of a mother hen. I like to make sure that my staff on shift are supported. And now for me, it's an awesome opportunity in my role now to be a clinical lead and to be that voice for the frontline clinicians.
What about you, Stephanie?
Similar to Lita, I also was a bit of a mother hen on the ward. And I was in a lot of codes and situations over my last 9 years working as a clinical nurse specialist in plastics and trauma. And I've seen a lot of situations that were actually quite challenging that ended up working out quite well. And we're like, wow, on reflection, that went quite well. And other situations that escalated really quick that we just couldn't have preempted at that specific time. So I started to think a lot about, you know, what can we do better? What can we improve on? How can we, you know, research and have a look at all the things that we can proactively do in the future. So I joined the Management of Clinical Aggression team in 2017, and then only a year after that then went and did the travel scholarship to New York City, where we benchmarked one of the oldest hospitals in America, and had a look at their services, and then also went to more level one trauma hospitals in Canada and the violence in aggression conference over there in Toronto. So it was really good to see what people were doing internationally. So I'm very passionate in what we can do that's proactive to help the situation for our frontline health workers.
Yeah, cool. I think we'll touch on some of those in a bit later as well, because I mean this is all about violence and aggression, but like it'll be interesting to hear about how we prevent that in the first place. So Jim, what about yourself?
I took leave from nursing in mid-90s and went trained as a prison officer in the UK. And that's the first time that I ever did any structured training in the management of aggression and violence. It was the old, what they call control and restraint. And it was just a structured program. When I went back then to nursing, I kind of realised that there wasn't much structure. And then in the secure units I went to work in, they started using very similar models. And because I knew all the stuff, I got kind of pulled to one side and asked if I'd like to be an instructor. So I became a CNR instructor back in 2000-something. And it just went on from there. Since then, in the UK, Australia, various different models. And one of the things about I find strange is that the UK have lots of qualifications in this area, aggression management, advanced physical restraint, structure, mechanical restraints. And over here, they don't really in Oz. I think there's a few. But I just go back to the UK and do lots of CPD. It's just a passionate area of mine. I've seen injuries. I've been injured, so I just want to try and make medical staff, clinical staff safe.
Yeah, right. And I think we've got another bit of an accent with Trevor.
Thank you very much, Jackson. Yeah, I think for me, it's been secondary to my choices about work. When I first went into nursing and I worked on a 26-bed secure male unit, I then progressed from there to a regional secure unit, the prison service, came to Australia, worked in a secure unit, a detention centre, and now train this. I think it's just been a natural progression for me that, unfortunately, the secondary problem, I suppose, of working in the high-risk areas is you're dealing with aggression. So if I can share anything with anybody about how to keep themselves safe, that's certainly where I'm heading to.
Yeah, right. Okay, so there's quite a variety of experiences. We've got prison officers and they've got a wide variety of sort of perspectives. So I guess my next sort of goes to my next question, which is really about the language that we use. There's a lot of terms. So when I used to work with you, Jim, behaviours of concern was a common word. So patients with box, behaviours of concerns. A lot of other health services have never heard of that before. And then we've got behavioural emergencies, clinical aggression and violence, occupational violence, challenging behaviours. So my question is sort of like for all of you, I guess, whoever wants to chime in first is, should we have a universal language about what this is?
I think we should have a universal everything. I think we all tend to, reinvent the wheel a little bit. We are all talking about the same thing. Even in Queensland, we have what we've always called it occupational violence, but our regulator, so Work Health Safety Queensland, calls it workplace violence and aggression. So, there are definitely different terms which can be really, really confusing to, staff when they're actually trying to manage these sorts of situations.
It was interesting when I was over in Canada at the conference, they presented six hospitals that came together and they had the joint centres was their names, and they had the same risk assessment, the same universal safety precautions, the same treatment and management, the same flagging system, everything, so that they had that continuity of care for their patients in that whole kind of Toronto area. So I was really impressed by that. So that's definitely something that we could look into in the future here in Australia.
Yeah. I personally think that occupational violence is the correct terminology for the reason of that in my 30 years of being a psychiatric nurse, probably 2% would have been violence that I've seen has had actual intent to hurt somebody. I'm dealing with very unwell individuals, and to call it occupational violence is about us. It's about we're enduring that violence because of our occupation. However, the intent isn't there of harm, I don't think. For all you that you made the quote that I made that it, there has been an increase in violence, I don't think it's an increase in intent of violence, rather than we're dealing with people who, for whatever reason, are going to behave aggressively.
Brent Driscoll has just commented, I believe he's a paramedic and a nurse, and he says planned versus unplanned violence and aggression as potential terms. That's an interesting one. Haven't heard that one before.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. We've got thanks for joining, Carolyn. Good evening, everyone from Melbourne, and also Joan from Sydney. Thanks, everyone who's commenting. So that's an interesting point. I sort of understand that we are enduring it and the intent isn't necessarily there to actively harm people in some cases, yeah.
I think, Jackson, just quickly, occupational violence to me is an umbrella term, because occupational violence can also encompass staff-to-staff aggression and bullying and stuff. So I'd like to use that as an umbrella term, and in clinical aggression is something that it's a term I'd prefer to use, because it's aggression in clinical settings. Then you could go down further from that. You could go planned and unplanned aggression. Is it someone who's got cognitive issues, or is it someone who's actually intently being aggressive?
Do you find,
and I think this is where the different jurisdictions, sorry, Jackson, go, how, you know, different states have different terminology, because our scope, particularly as a statewide unit, is all about violence as a perpetrator. And you know, there's an endorsed definition that Queensland Health goes by. As Trevor was saying, it's very much about the violence that's perpetrated from patients or visitors onto our staff. But the scope completely removes any staff on staff or bullying, purely for the fact that that has its own HR sort of process and management, whereas OV for us is very, very dynamic and fluid. It changes so frequently, so many causes, it's multifactorial. So I guess different jurisdictions and different states will have different views on that, but I completely agree with the clinical component of it.
Okay. My next question is about, I guess a lot of the public don't, they may not realise sort of the reality of what us as clinicians face, which is part of, I guess, the reason why I wanted to do this sort of discussion and release the video that we're going to release on Monday, which is about real sort of cinematic experiences of nurses. So my question is, what's the reality on the ground that the average person may not realize about violence that exists? If you guys could draw on some of your experiences personally or from those who from around you. Maybe Jim, did you want to start with that one?
I think there's a full spectrum. It goes from verbal abuse, racial abuse, sexualized abuse, verbal threats, sexualized threats, up to physical assault, up to weapons. And I was talking to you earlier on, Jackson, I'm getting more and more requests now for training for areas that I wouldn't have thought there would be aggression. But we're talking telehealth, we're talking GP liaisons who are getting abuse and aggression off other clinicians, off patients across the telephone. And even now, because of the COVID pandemic, video calls and aggression on video calls, you know, people sort of leaning into the camera and all sorts of stuff. And you just kind of, I wouldn't have thought this from my background in the forensics and stuff and secure units. But, you know, weapons is a big thing. There's lots of weapons in being brought out in healthcare now, be it improvised weapons or actual weapons being brought into hospitals as well.
What about some of you other guys, your experiences? What would you say to the average person?
For me, Jackson, I think I may have read this question a little bit different to what Jim's just said there. But the way I looked at it, it would be if I was sitting talking to somebody who was talking about nursing or healthcare per se, and I said to them, well, what do you think that a nurse may end up getting injured from. And I would imagine they would say things like, well, helping patients in bed, handling, etc. And that is the biggest cost to the health service. But the biggest risk is actually occupational violence. There are more reports of occupational violence than there are of patient handling. So it's about putting it into context. I don't think the general public actually understand how much violence there is throughout healthcare. And as Jim said before, in various forms.
We'll sort of move to my next question, which is there a particular experience or story that sort of sticks in over your careers, that sticks in your memory about violence against a nurse or even yourself? Maybe Lita, did you want to, I know you've talked publicly about this before, did you sort of want to talk about your personal experience with that?
So unfortunately I have had a number of experiences, but obviously for me the most serious was when I was pregnant with my daughter. She is a very sassy 10-year-old, nearly 10-year-old now, so I'm very lucky that she was fine. But essentially it was night shift and, you know, there was at the time, a 54-year-old patient who had, fallen off a stool while he was intoxicated on a Bucks night. And he was actually really, really good with me. So he had a laceration to his head. We'd been chatting for a little while. And for whatever reason, whilst I was doing his dressing, he sort of jumped up and went over the barricade of the bed rails and punched me straight, sort of collecting me right across the tummy and chest. Obviously, being heavily pregnant, that was a big risk for me. That is my most significant, I guess, experience. I've had nights at triage where people have come with bombs strapped to their chest or bombs strapped to their chest. And I was just very lucky that I was able to talk this person down at the time. It was certainly, quite harrowing in the moment to find out, until you find out that it actually is an empty deodorant can and this particular person just really wanted to hurt his neighbour who was, putting in complaints about his cat. So, look, my experiences are they're obviously my most significant ones. There are absolutely the continual verbal and threatening behaviours. I've also had to support staff in an adjoining mental health unit where, unfortunately, after where the Royal Brisbane is situated is right opposite where we normally would have raves and festivals and things like that at the showgrounds. Again, the patient was completely compliant overnight but went around to the mental health unit under a treatment order, and when he was around there, opportunistically targeted a very small statured nurse. In fact, he injured all three of the staff that were around there, which meant that I was in charge of the emergency department at the time, so having to relocate, 12 to 15 mental health patients, as well as treat all of those staff, unfortunately some of which have never returned to work. You don't think that you're going to be establishing a crime scene while you're in charge of an emergency department. But, I guess they're my most serious memories, but also my biggest drivers for what we do.
Yeah, wow. Trevor, did you have a sort of a defining moment?
What I was going to say is that I actually use this subject deliberately when I teach occupational violence training, and I always ask the group to introduce themselves and to give me some examples of things that they've encountered, whether it be dementia patient who's tried to scratch them or somebody who shouted at them, etc. And very, very often the group will come out with a comment, or somebody from the group will come out with a comment like, or nothing really for me, just verbal. And that actually frightens me because we play that down too much. All of the time that I've been involved in some quite serious incidents, right up the riot level, etc., that's not what sticks in my mind. My experience was from a patient who I knew very, very well and looked after for a long time. I was nursing him in the community, a community setting, I should say, and he made direct threats towards my children, and he knew where they went to school, would have been able to access them, etc. And that was worse than any physical thing that anybody could ever do to me. Mm.
So the miniseries that we're, if anyone is following the Nurse Break, would know that we're going to release, you've probably seen the trailer. I was planning to show you a sort of a snippet of the 10-minute video, but I'll keep that for Monday. So next Monday, come in. One of the nurses, Helen, talks about, you know, she used to be a nurse unit manager of one of the biggest emergency departments in Australia. And she talks about staff members, a patient who threatened her children. It's a really personal threat. Just yesterday, I had a nurse who, because of this sort of stuff I'm doing with the Nurse Break, sort of told me personally in a conversation at a group table that she had, you know, a patient say, I'm going to find you and rape your children in front of you at home. And that really traumatized that nurse. And it made that nurse want to carry a pen or something when they leave and not even leave work. And then another nurse said, I mean, the amount of emails I've been getting of stories of, this is traumatic, I'm sorry, but of digitally being raped, of being stabbed, of being knocked unconscious, pinned against walls, personal threats to themselves and their family members, especially their children. That's, yeah, the verbal abuse is mind-blowing, as someone said in the video that we'll release. So, yeah, it's crazy. Stephanie or Jim, did you sort of have a defining moment that you're willing to share? Sorry,
can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
I didn't realize I was muted. I don't really have a specific story. I've been through a lot of different situations over the last 9 years. And it's just, I think, there's some big ones where you think, wow, did that really happen? And I was very fortunate to be with a great team and have an immediate debrief on site with security and police and the team that was on, and was able to work through that, you know, with the right support, and didn't feel unsafe coming back to work, so because I was able to process it properly. But I think it's the everyday, the small little niggly and the big verbal just constantly wears you down over time. And I think we all have, you know, that glass that's, you know, half full or full, and we need to always check in with ourselves and know where we're at in regards to that. So, yeah, I think that everyday kind of verbal occupational aggression can really wear you down over time. And I think that us clinicians are very tough and try and put it to the back burner, but it does affect us, and we do really need to keep on top of our own well-being and make sure we're looking after ourselves and the team.
I think that's a very important sort of comment you just said there. We'll go to my next question, Jim. I'm sure you have hundreds of stories we could have gone through. My next question is, what are the main causes of violence that you guys notice? So I've mentioned a few, so drug and alcohol, delirium and dementia, visitors and stress, and trying to advocate for their family members, mental health. What else am I missing? And sort of what do you guys think are the main causes of violence that you see in your own workplaces?
Entitlement. Add on to all of them things, entitlement. It's a world where you can get food delivered to your house, you can buy things online, instant gratification. And we are sort of, you know, in my career, I've seen people cannot wait for more than 10 minutes now to be seen. If I had to go to emergency as a kid, you'd expect 2 or 3 hours. You know, you never had iPods, never had phones in them days. You had a TV behind a big screen, but you deal with it. But nowadays, people are just demanding to be seen straight away. And they're using things like, do you know who I am? Do you know who I know? I've got money and stuff. And that, for me, all those things on your screen, absolutely. But there's a sense of entitlement these days about being seen in hospital.
Trevor?
Yeah, this is one of my babies, actually. And what I've wrote on the piece of paper that you put this question on was none of the above. I don't think that's where violence comes from. And I get quite upset that my primary job is to look after people with mental illness. And when I hear people who don't fully understand what's going on say, he's aggressive because he's mentally ill. That's not the truth. The truth is that people become aggressive, okay? Yeah, Jim's pointed out there is people who have entitlement, people who think they can pressure people, etc. That's more your predatory behavior. But if you've got somebody who is out of touch with reality because of a serious mental illness or because of dementia or because of a head injury or whatever, they go through exactly the same emotions that we do. If you think about the last time you were angry, for instance, something would have happened. You would have been either afraid or frustrated, or something is going to raise your anxiety levels. If those anxiety levels keep getting raised, the next thing that's going to happen is anger. If you are average Joe, you can assert yourself. You can say to somebody, I need to be out of this situation. I can't put up with this. I can't do that. But if you're unwell, if you've got a serious mental illness or a dementia, you can't be assertive like that. So the next line from anger is going to be aggression, stroke violence. Hence what I said before. The majority of stuff I've dealt with in my 30 year hasn't come from people who's had an intent to harm me. It's because they're unwell, and I'm trying to either stop them from doing something, make them do something, and they become frustrated or afraid of the situation, and the anxiety levels increase. So I see it as a very cyclical event that we together would go through if we were going to become aggressive, and so would somebody else with any of those titles, i.e. mental illness, head injury, drugs and alcohol, whatever. I haven't come across a lot of predators except maybe in the prison system.
Interesting perspectives. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Later on, Steph, did you have anything to add for this one?
I work with peripherally with an amazing colleague who is a staunch advocate for the Dementia Delirium cohort, and she refers to this exact conversation as people with unmet needs, and so regardless of how they communicate with or how, you know, how they communicate their needs, or if we are even, you know, have the time or the ability or capacity to understand their needs, you know, regardless of whether it be drug, alcohol, dementia, delirium, visitors, mental health, wayfinding, like the list just goes on. There's a huge component that's also societal. I think it would be naive to think that with the amount of violence in society that when people cross over into, you know, hospital or health land, that violence is going to cease because there's this invisible wall there that says that you can't be violent here. But I do think that we need to appreciate that people don't come to hospital for the fun of it. It's not, you know, shits and giggles, excuse my mouth. You know, they come because it's the best day, the worst day, their first day or their last day. You know, and I think that's why we are nurses. We come to help them through that process. I'm not saying that we should excuse it, but they're vulnerable in their own way. And I've had some very, very robust conversations with people who, you know, respectfully disagree, and that's completely fine. I think there's lots of different versions of this. But I think we need to acknowledge that, you know, a 25-year-old who's gone out on a massive bender, you know, on methamphetamines for 3 days, and then is brought in by the police because he's unsafe and is in an emergency department and in a heightened and, you know, not of sound mind state, then that's just as vulnerable as, you know, a nana in the room next door who's come in with a raging UTI who is, you know, off tap. They're vulnerable in different ways, but they're both very vulnerable. But that's my humble opinion.
Thank you for sharing that. Stephanie, did you have anything to add?
I think we're just missing the part that people have sometimes been through trauma early on in their life, and that can be an issue when they come into the hospital system. And there is a big topic of trauma-informed care, and I'm not going to get into it right now because it's, you know, a very, very in-depth education and research piece. But people who do come in can have a very heightened stress response because they feel unsafe because of their past. And we've got to remember with people, the biggest triggers can be fear, frustration, and powerlessness. And everyone deserves the right to adequate healthcare. So it is definitely not okay that, you know, clinicians feel unsafe, but as, at the same time, the patients are feeling unsafe as well. So I guess in society, it's becoming a very unsafe environment for us all, and it's kind of triggering different emotions that are actually bubbling up as anger, because often we like to express anger first, and underneath that is the feelings and emotions that we're too scared and vulnerable to talk about. And that's a complex issue. So there's not going to be a solution to that today. But yeah, there's a lot that would go into that.
Yeah. I mean, every question I ask, we could, as I mentioned before, we could do a whole hour, 2-3 day session on these just single questions. Thank you to, there's about 35 people watching currently. And there's a bunch of questions coming through. I will tackle them. So keep posting your questions in the comments, guys. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, just literally type them. You can make them specific to a certain personal theme, and I will go through them. This, what we've just sort of spoken about, goes neatly to my next question, which is about the attitude of healthcare workers that patients come first, slash our altruistic gene as healthcare workers, i.e. not to report because, you know, it wasn't the patient's fault or things like that. So with all that stuff you guys have talked about, keeping that in mind, do you think, what do you think about this, about healthcare workers not blaming and not reporting sometimes because we care too much?
I like to call this the ethical dilemma. So for me, it's about, I think it is an ethical dilemma that we, you know, teeter on all day, every day. You know, we rationalize why a patient does it for all the reasons that we've all just spoken about. And I definitely think that we are trained to prioritize, you know, we are there for the patient to make them better, and that's what we do. And so we're nurturers, and particularly in emergency departments, you know, that's our job. But I think for me, it's very much about, we talk to people about danger, response, airway, breathing, circulation, and I swear every single person thinks that the danger component is going to be a defib, which, you know, is in a pool of water. No one thinks about it as whether I am in a violent situation or whether this particular incident could be violent. And the response should be the exact same, but, you know, naturally we go to, oh, you know, there's going to be water and electricity and walls falling down, but no one thinks about, you know, what they're actually walking into and what could be construed as a weapon. But I think there's a significant amount of compassion fatigue. I think staff are burnt out, and should, you know, if they were going to report every time they were called lots of colourful names, then, you know, nurses would never actually get anything done at the bedside. So what we see, particularly, obviously I can speak to Queensland, what we see here is that staff are more likely to report an incident if they are physically injured, if they require time off, or if it, you know, goes through a work cover claim or common law type claim. So I think it's complex. I think we do a lot of justifying. There's we're trying to break a lot of that stigma around nothing's going to happen. You know, if we do, if we report it, so what's the point? But we try and use that data to show people that we can make a difference if we know how bad the issue is.
Do any other guys have anything to add to what Leda just said? I agree completely with what you're saying, Leda. Yeah, so the attitude of healthcare workers that patients come first, do you think that puts us in danger sometimes?
Yeah, very much agree with what Leda said there, but a thing that I would add to it, though, is that this has got to be balanced out as well. We talk about patients coming first, and Yes, we've got a duty of care. Yes, that's our main aim in life, to be able to look after our patient, etc. But that has to be balanced. And I think when I mentioned about the, well, I can't remember saying cataclysmic, but I must have at some stage if you found it. If it's a cataclysmic rise in aggression, I would say that it's about that balance, that anything that I do at work, whether it's an assessment of a patient, whether it's admission, whether it's administering medication, where I think there is possibility of risk, I've got to balance that with my safety. And I think it comes the same with reporting. I think with the reporting, we've almost got to accept that it's a probably tiny percentage that gets reported because of the things that later said. If I reported every time I was sworn out of work, I would never leave the desk. That's all I'd be writing. It would just be, yeah. So you've got to categorize and you've got to work out what's the balance here and where does that change the risk? Or is there an easy way of reporting? It's an interesting thing.
One of the commenters, thank you for that, Trevor. One of the commenters has said everyone deserves the right to not be belted in the workplace. And Lou Dingle has popped up in the comments. Interesting. Every other industry ensures staff safety first. I think nurses minimize the impact on themselves, often due to being busy or many other excuses. Great discussion. Lockie has said some issues can be that some clinicians can be very naive to people in situations. The role of care can often overrun the self-preservation and prevention of harm to others and themselves. There's a whole bunch of other questions coming in. Brett, look, we might tackle this question a bit later, but Brett asks, what measures do you think are needed to diffuse training and tools to staff to minimize aggression and violence? We'll get to that one a bit later, Brett, but great question. And also all the other questions that are coming in. My next question for all of you guys, maybe we'll start with Jim, is it getting worse and why?
Stats-wise, from where we are, yes, it's getting worse. But that could be because of increased reporting, because we're actually getting a lot more reporting now. Those of you know, Jackson and Steph will know, that we have this platform called RiskMan in Victoria, and it was best way I would call it cumbersome and long-winded, and that puts people off reporting. So we are getting more reports. Stats have gone higher from where we are. Reasons, I think COVID has been a big issue. To be honest, we've had lots of stress coming through the doors, maybe a bit more mental health, but we've had people in the first lockdown, we're doing DIY at home, for example, get injured, come to hospital, and then get frustrated that they're in a queue, they're waiting for a while to see a doctor. I think Lita made a good point. There is kind of compassion fatigue. There is staff burnout as well. And I genuinely do believe that, you know, a lot of nursing staff, from what I can hear and what I'm seeing on the ground, are kind of rethinking their careers. They're rethinking all sorts. And sometimes you question their attitudes then. Maybe, you know, are they being a bit kind of, you know, sharp and short? I don't know. But definitely increased during COVID from where we are.
Steph, we can still see you. I know your lights have just disappeared, but you are very visible still. maybe Steph, do you think it's getting worse from your end?
We're in a similar position here, like Jim. We've had an increase in reporting. We've also had an increase in education in reporting as well, through management of clinical aggression. Definitely not as much reporting coming through compared to the amount of codes coming through. So, and we don't want to see codes dropping, because that means people aren't getting an emergency team response or people with them. So the data is interesting to follow, but it's not always true and accurate of what's happening. So it would be great to see reporting increase so we can capture what really happens in the situation. But then I do understand, being a clinician on the floor myself, these reports through RiskMan are really, you know, difficult to put through. I've learnt to put them through as quick as I can, but I do understand that it's really busy. So yeah, it'd be great if in the future there's a OVA system for reporting that's a little bit easier, but at the moment I think we're just stuck with what we've got.
Lita, you're in the sort of strategy sort of side of this in Queensland specifically.
Yep.
Have you had any sort of work in this in regards to, you know, not only is it getting worse, but I guess the reporting side of it?
Yes. And Jim, unfortunately, Queensland is in risk man as well.
Oh.
So I feel your pain. Look, I think we definitely have a bigger focus in terms of people reporting, and we want people to be able to have a non-punitive response when they are reporting an incident. So we want them to report it. We want to be able to provide them the appropriate support, and we want to make sure that they're safe and you know, continue to be able to work. I would suggest that our risk man data is limited and certainly not a source of truth. Quite often we'll use our security interventions, so our security across Queensland, although they use different systems, some are on the same system and some are quite sophisticated. We recently did a scoping exercise where we saw about 90,000 or 92,000 security interventions in the last year. Occupational violence related security interventions. So that's not every time you forget your keys and you need security to come and unlock the door for you, or you need them to go to a helipad or something like that. So these are OV related incidents. And we've seen in the last financial year about 9,500 risk men. So big discrepancies there. So is it getting worse? Yes, the stories on the ground are definitely that it's happening more frequently. We would like to see an increase in reporting and a decrease in severity.
I don't think the numbers tell the whole scope of the issue. You see, there was an article recently and they quoted the Victorian Crime Statistics Agency and it said something along the lines of 300 to 400 episodes of violence against healthcare workers. And I was like, that's a week in one health service. Is the data, do you guys think, is there a national database that captures the amount of episodes of violence of co-greys and co-blacks? Do you think there should be?
I definitely think at least at a state level to start with, there needs to be some real visibility, because if people want to, you know, make a real difference and put their money where their mouth is, then we need to know how big the problem is. Under-reporting is a global phenomenon. This is not new. Mm-hmm. It's not unique to us. But for us to be able to adequately support staff, retain our staff and make sure that they can deliver exceptional care, we need to know how big the problem is.
Mm.
Yeah, for me, it's back to what I said before. It's about that acceptance that we're not capturing it all. We've got to realise that there's stuff happening out there that it isn't being reported for whatever reason. And we're probably seeing more people. The world's getting bigger. Yes, we're reporting more than we used to, et cetera. So the figures have gone up there. But that's not really my major worry. Being a clinician within, my major worry is the severity of what people are prepared to do now has gone off the map. It's not just people throwing a punch at you anymore. They're actually coming to hospital armed. So that's my major worry, not the numbers. I can live with the numbers.
I'm curious, Stephanie, you've been to the US recently and also Canada, and they're a country, you know, that everyone's aware are well armed, and probably open carry is potentially a thing that's allowed in some of the states you went to. So I'm curious, how did they tackle, you know, the gun violence, and then also open carry, which for those who aren't aware means people can legally carry a gun on them in public?
So in America, they do have watchmen who are security, and they are out in the foyer watching over, and they've got all the keys and they're locking the doors and things like that and doing watchman duties. And then they have hospital police, and they are at every lift. They're at every entrance. You have to actually go in and have an ID. I got a sticker printed off. They needed proof of who I was before I came up for a meeting with their executive. I needed an approval from someone. They're quite strict with people coming in the hospital with their entry and exit points, and there wasn't as many visitors floating around either. It wasn't as busy. They really watch their environment. But they do have different challenges, keep in mind.
What do you guys think about the free access that people have into hospitals? I mean, I've been on wards, for example, where there have been people armed with weapons, especially in a trauma unit, to finish off the job, for example. You know, they'd already injured someone and they wanted to finish the job. So people can walk into an emergency department or a ward or anywhere with a weapon. Do you think there needs to be security, like an airport sort of system in Australia?
COVID's made entry to our hospital a bit more difficult, you know, and obviously restrictions have made it more difficult for people to come in. But a lot of hospitals, big hospitals, they have, as you know, Jackson, yourself at the Alfred, we've got a post office, we've got shops, we've got a cafe. So before COVID, people were walking in anyway to get stamps, to post parcels and stuff. You know, it's. I think people mentioned getting the balance right. Do we want airport security? Do we want security guards? Do we want PCOs with guns at the ED? You know, will that day come? Possibly. Hopefully it's not in my lifetime, but, you know, when, you know, Trevor's mentioned weapons, we've had weapons and all sorts. Free access, as I say, it's got tighter because of COVID. But when COVID dissipates, then I think it'll be back to normal. It's actually been quite good for me because going back to when I trained, seeing hospitals with visiting hours, that's how it used to be years ago. And I think it's a lot more regulated then when it's set hours for visiting.
Sort of goes to my next question, Jim, I might get you to continue. I sort of want to touch on what are the models of aggression or violence management that exist. And I guess over your careers, how has this changed or progressed?
Oh, when I trained as a student nurse from 86 to 89, aggression management used to be the biggest guys got involved. If you were tall, if you were stocky, you played sport, you were called, and this was before pagers and all sorts, you were called on the ward phone and you ran and you jumped on people. There was mattresses being used as shields, and then obviously you got the prison service in the UK started using control and restraint. That filtered down to the special hospitals and then secure units, RSUs and secure units. That was kind of like there was pain compliance, there was wrist locks. But it was a definite model. It's still being used in certain areas now. But from there, there's been lots of models. The UK, I guess, are probably fairly, they're leading the way in models, probably too many models. There are some standards, but you're using MABOL up in Queensland later in certain areas. I was a MABOL instructor as well. Great model, conflict management, not just going down in restraints. And there's lots of different models there, and they're actually going down the full spectrum of primary, secondary and tertiary responses, which is good. In the olden days, it was just the only tool in your box was restraint. So it's good to see the models have developed into that. What I found in Australia is, I don't know what it's like up in Queensland, and I don't know what your staff at Royal Melbourne, but time, they don't seem to want to give 4 and 5 days training like we would have in the UK. And whether it's a financial implication, I don't know, but, you know, I run a 1 day course. I'd love that course to be 4 days at least, but it's not. So, you know, there's good and bad.
Trevor, you wrote an article and you sort of talked about how you think nurses need a sort of foundation course almost prior to entry into nursing. Do you want to sort of touch on what you think of that?
Yeah. For me, I think most courses now, a bit like Jim said there before, they've got their act together, they've got the theoretical, they've got the understanding of where aggression comes from, how to try to de-escalate, what to do, blah, blah, blah. And that would cover the majority of our healthcare staff. But it's the bit at the top. It's that tiny percentage at the top who are dealing with the restricted practices, the restraints, etc. And what I would like to see, and I think it is happening, that we're actually providing now an understanding that not for people to say, oh, aggression is part of my job, because it shouldn't be. It should never be accepted as part of your job. But what we do need to realize is that we're going to come across it. How we then deal with it is different in every single situation. If a nurse says to me, this patient became aggressive, so I backed off, I left the room, and I went and told my CN or CNC or whatever, that's all that's expected of a nurse, for them to discharge the responsibility. So I think if we can cover the masses with the understanding you may come across this in your career, this is what we want you to do, and have more specialized responses to the more difficult stuff, the stuff at the top. That's how I see it.
We'll move to my next question. Thanks for sharing that, guys. I might start with Stephanie for this one. And it's when everything we're talking about doesn't work and we get to the point of physical, chemical, and mechanical restraint. Can you sort of talk about some of your research overseas? And I remember when we chatted, you talked about prone restraint and a few other aspects. What did you find were some of the differences or similarities?
Overseas, they were using different restraints that had mechanical locks that could be had a key that the nurses who were looking after them wore and the nurse in charge, and that could undo the restraint for quick access if there was a medical emergency. And also the restraint was quite secure compared to the Velcro type of restraint that had previously been used in acute care here in Australia. So that was something interesting that we saw over there. Also the use of prone restraint is not used in acute care, but we use supine restraint. Over there, they were quite similar in that. And they did have their seclusion rooms for their mental health patients. And for mental health, it's quite different to acute care. So they're not able to actually use mechanical restraints. They use the seclusion rooms and the physical restraint. Whereas in acute care, because we have a duty of care to the patient and because there may be a safety risk for them, the rules are different there, just to prevent, if a patient is pulling something, an airway out or something that they need. So there is different rules in that aspect. But, yeah, it's just interesting to see the different restraints from overseas and to see how abouts they go in acute care.
Mm. Jim, did you sort of just want to quickly sort of, for those who aren't aware, can you sort of define what the differences are between these three? So some maybe the things that nurses need to be aware of in regards to each of them. Your silence, sorry.
Sorry about that. I should know that in this COVID pandemic, shouldn't I? So physical, in lay terms, is where we are using our bodies or our hands in particular to restrict their movements. Mechanical is where we use various maybe cuffs. For example, in the UK, they're using handcuffs in some hospitals, actual steel handcuffs. They could be using soft cuffs. We could be using the mechanical restraints, the posies, or the Hemco restraints. And chemical restraint, I personally hate that term. I think it's a disgusting term. I hate it. Mm. It's where we use drugs to keep people quiet, to stop them moving, to stop them being aggressive. And we're using some very powerful drugs in EDs. In some areas, some EDs now, they're also intubating patients because the aggression is so high, and so severe. But that's the main difference.
Yeah, I've got a few friends who are paramedics, and some of the stories where they're injecting ketamine into pediatrics, 14, 15-year-olds who are unmanageable, is becoming a very common theme. Is that's almost the ambulance, their go-to drug. The other drugs that I've seen used is quite often in the pre-hospital context, not by ambulance services specifically, but is midazolam. The other sort of benzos, and in emergency departments, a common one, I'm not sure about what you guys see, but droperidol. But obviously it depends on, the past history of the patient, their medical conditions. Do they have a dementia? What type of dementia? Because that sort of guides which medications as well. But it's interesting that, yes, people do get tubed. They get intubated and put on a ventilator for their aggression is so unmanageable. Something that the public may not realize is that effectively we paralyze people and put a breathing tube in them, because how else do you manage them until a psychiatrist can come and come up with a plan? I think that's something that people don't realize that happens. I've seen it on the ward twice where a patient was tubed as well for aggression. One was a visitor as well. So it's unbelievable the amount. What is a different word would you say for chemical restraint? Would you say pharmacological restraint? Like what's the alternative, Jim, that you'd like to see used?
The term I like, and people don't like it, is a therapeutic sedation.
Oh, that's a good one.
I just think that's a better term than chemical restraint. It just reminds, has all these conjures up images of one flew over the cuckoo's nest and stuff like that, you know. But, you know, when we are tubing people, a lot of the time it can be people who've taken amphetamines and they've got super strength. They're at risk of becoming hypothermic, acidotic. And so it's actually safer for them as well at times, and obviously staff as well.
Lita, did you have anything to add in regards to this sort of topic of restraint?
No, I guess only that Queensland has absolutely moved away from pain compliance in terms of any sort of restraint. The teaching of pain compliance techniques, obviously removing things from going into a prone position is a priority. There are some health services in Queensland that use handcuffs and have been using them quite successfully for some time, but that's not across the board. I think what it does do is contain the environment really quickly to allow for security to either engage the police or for, the situation to be deemed safe. There's conflicting opinions on that. I quite like the therapeutic sedation that you're talking about, though, Jim. I like that term. Certainly in the pre-hospital setting, Queensland uses droperidol far more than ketamine. We've definitely moved away from MADAS as a first point of call. I think with droperidol, at least it's fast acting and it's got a short half-life. So, you know, there's some added bonuses to get the situation under control. Yes, I have seen my fair share of patients intubated because of their behaviour. But often it's also an underlying drug-induced something. So, you know, probably 10 years ago we saw a really big spike in the use of Fantasy or GHB, which has got a three-day lifespan in some people. So when they drop from they're a GCS-15 with super strength, 45-kilo women with, 4 or 5 security officers and police hanging off them, and then a very flat GCS-3. So from a management point of view, absolutely, it is sometimes the safest thing. I don't know that we've actually ever intubated a visitor though.
Not ideal, is it? My next question was on top tips for de-escalating patients. So ideally, this is a 3-day seminar in itself. But if you had one tip, just one each, for de-escalating a patient, what would it be? Trevor, did you want to start with yours?
Very, very simple for me. Be nice.
Yep.
If you're nice to somebody, the chances of them wanting to hurt you are minimal.
Yeah.
I like that. I think that summarizes it. Leader, your tip.
Know your limits. No one is completely efficient in de-escalating 100% of the time. So I think, I speak for Queensland, I don't think that we always engage security or escalate as early as we should. So we need to recognise the signs, but it's very much about knowing when to tap out.
Jim and Stephanie.
I hate it when people tell an angry person to calm down, because it's just like putting petrol onto a fire. And so, you know, it's one of the big things on our course. Don't use them two magic words, because those magic words do not work.
It's really hard to pick one. But since you've all gone for some of the other ones that are important, I'll go identify feelings and wants, because that would be the underlying core issue behind that aggression or anger that's coming at you. So if you're thinking of an iceberg and anger's the tip of the iceberg, we need to figure out what the core issue is, because this person may be admitted to the hospital and then have surgery or have a stay that may be days or weeks with us. So we do need to figure out what the core issue is so that we can come up with a plan.
I like Trevor's or whoever mentioned before about the unmet needs. I think that it's almost like the umbrella term. If you can figure out what they are or what you just said, Steph, then you can often de-escalate patients. They might just want a tea, or they might just have urinary retention and need to do a wee. Something so simple. We'll do another one. It's maybe just one from each of you. What do you find is often the common pitfalls, traps, or mistakes that nurses make that can get themselves injured or make someone angrier? So we've sort of touched on that just then, but was there anything else you guys wanted to add about that?
I think it's virtually the opposite of what we just said. If you've got a patient who has got unmet needs, etc., and they're trying to put their point of view across, the frustrated, the frightened, the anxious, the becoming aggressive, etc., the two worst things for me that the nurse can do, and I'll often stand back and watch younger nurses in particular when they're first dealing with potentially quite dodgy situations to see how they handle it, is that they'll either become defensive and want to argue with the patient, or become authoritarian and try to tell them what they want them to do, instead of trying to meet those needs, instead of trying to deal with the situation or try to understand it, all of a sudden it becomes personal. And it's not about us, it's about the patient.
My next question is sort of the flip side of everything we were talking about, is what are some of the solutions? So, you know, for example, more security, more training. Later in 2016, I think you featured in a Brisbane Times article, which was healthcare workers. The title was healthcare workers to get body cameras, swipe cards, security, duress alarms in all settings. What do you guys think, maybe starting with Lita, what are some of the solutions to all these issues? And I know this is a ridiculously large question.
Well, firstly, we don't have, as clinicians, we don't have body worn cameras, but nearly all of Queensland Health security officers do. And they've been, you know, really, really valuable in terms of one, being a visual deterrent. Two, people are less likely to abuse you if you've got that opportunistic violence, if you've got a camera pointed at you, or they're more likely to comply with a simple direction, you know, to leave the premises or something like that if they know they're being recorded. But they're also really good for vexatious complaints. So, you know, and by default, it's had a really good impact on how people are speaking to each other. So that's a positive. In terms of solutions, certainly our unit, being a strategic unit, is all about looking at things while we've got a governance, big governance component. So it needs to have all the policy and procedures from the top right the way down. But for me, we need, or our unit looks at things under four pillars. So initiatives that sit around awareness, prevention, during the incident, and also in the post-incident space. And so all of our initiative based on sitting under one of those pillars. So we've got some initiatives around different models of care. So, you know, matrix and screening tools on how to respond if someone's behaviour is, you know, escalating or changing, how to recognise that. We've got the Ambassador Program, which is essentially it was a Canadian model that used covert security or less authoritative security in emergency departments, which reduced violence by 45%. We're rolling that out across a number of facilities in Queensland. And that's actually really helped to build the relationship between security and clinicians. And, you know, I like to ask clinicians if they feel like security are part of the clinical team, and probably 8 out of 10 times they're like, they're kind of part of the multidisciplinary team, but they're not part of the clinical team, whereas I like to think that they actually play quite a significant role in the patient's journey when they are involved. So, you know, by using someone who's in a less authoritative outfit and is able to identify early those changes, you know, we've then been able to demonstrate that there's been a really significant reduction in calls for security, but also a really significant increase in perceptions of staff safety and also the opinion of security being part of the clinical team. They're just a few. Mm.
Yeah, there's a lot there to take in, isn't there? Steph, you're in the dark, but we can still see you, I promise. Did you have any solutions that you'd like to add?
Look, it's a very complex issue and nothing is going to get fixed overnight. But I have seen a lot happening over the last few years. There is definitely a big increase in awareness, definitely a lot more resourcing coming through in the space of education. We've had increasing in our management of clinical aggression team and a lot of things that can help, like reviewing security, seeing if we can increase those resources. Some of these things are limited by funding from the government and the Department of Health, unfortunately, but also security rounding. A lot of the time, I believe a lot of the frontline workers have great solutions for problems in their local areas. So in the wards and the units, we actually run risk reduction workshops, and they will go through the environment, things that we can identify as risks and counter strategies, the situation for us as a team, what we can do better, and the patients. So, you know, things that we can do to help them through their stay, like all the referrals we can put in, all the extra resources for them. In the future, I'd like to see, you know, a lot more virtual reality when the funding comes through. And I think there's a lot in this space. Like, there's a lot that can happen that I've seen overseas. And especially Canada had a lot of high-tech equipment. So their healthcare system is definitely well-funded, I would say. They all had safety cards. So my lanyard here over in Canada, they all had a little button and they'd just push it if they felt unsafe. It was an individual GRS button. And their hospitals were quite high tech. They had a lot of like check-in centres and things for patients that helped make the environment more soothing for them. I think we can do a lot in the environment for the patient as well to make them have a more restful period after they're recovering from surgery, because it's a very noisy, small, cluttered environment. So, yeah, there's just a lot that we can do. It's not an easy question to answer quickly for you. But, yeah, there is a lot that can be done. And I think over the next 5 years, this space is going to grow quite hugely. I think the time is now. I think things are going to happen.
Yeah, I think you answered that beautifully. I know you have limited time, but I think that was a great, great shot at it. Jim, did you have any sort of final things that you wanted to add in regards to this?
I think three things. I think funding, like Steph mentioned, you know, we need to have more funding. We need to look at the healthcare system in general in Victoria. We're getting pumped. Maybe we should look at building bigger hospitals, et cetera, if we can. Training, I would go back and think of my days as a UK student nurse, and we streamed into disability or psychiatry and stuff. Over here, I've been shocked that you can do a generic nursing degree and then apply to be a psychiatric nurse. And you may have only done 4 weeks placement in your 3 years in that area, and you go and do your grad year. I don't think there's enough training at university for people. Like I think Trevor mentioned, there should be some kind of foundation. I think I teach at RMIT, and I've done some introductions to aggression and violence in healthcare sessions, but I don't think many of the universities do. And back to my training point again, half day, one day, I don't think cuts it. I think we need to have more training. Training's not the final solution as such to this. It's a small part of a big jigsaw, but I think staff have the right to be trained a lot better than what they are.
Yeah, I do agree. And my next question, guys, is we've got not many left, so we're closing up shortly. I know it's getting late. It's more about the sort of flip side of this. So should we be focusing on training people for psychological first aid too? Jim, maybe we'll start with you. Did you want to add to that? I remember, I think you were a psychological first aid trainer.
Yeah, so back in the UK, I was an incident, what they called an incident debriefer, first contact. And then over here, one of the things when I set up the AWARE course was I felt there was a need for post-incident support, immediate post-incident support. And I'm not saying, you know, the exact second after. So all of my co-trainers and myself, we've all been trained in psychological first aid. There's an online course, John Hopkins, and also Phoenix, Australia. And we're actually, the last 12 months, we've held a lot more sessions than normal in this, groups and individuals. I think it's an absolute must that every hospital has people who can provide psychological first aid.
Leda, did you want to add to that?
Yeah. Jackson, we actually took the onus out of, I guess we wanted to take some of the pressure off, you know, individual managers and staff, and provide them with something to be able to step through those processes based on psychological first aid. So going back to my experience that I mentioned earlier with the mental health, adjoining mental health unit, that where all the staff were injured and we had to establish a crime scene, one of the biggest drivers for me after that particular incident was that even at a nursing level where I was in charge of, 90-odd patients in an emergency department, I was never provided tools or training in how to support a staff member after an incident. So I did a lot of chatting with people of my level and around the state, and everybody was in the same boat. So we knew how to do a hot cold debrief after a big resus or a trauma, but never around how to psychologically support someone. So I'm very privileged to be in the position that I'm in a strategy unit where we can take some of that onus off the individual health services or the individual facilities or nursing lines or whoever it is to be able to give them a tool to do that. So we have actually created an incident response kit specific to OV, but it's actually been used for things like security. Have used it after Code Purples, which is like our bomb threats. So it steps through the process on what to do. It's a look, listen, link approach, just like I can't see all of this, but kind of just steps right through, and it goes right from the time the incident occurs all the way through to how to support the person right after the incident, maintaining the situation, obviously, how to look out for those individual people, give them treatment, stepping through to reporting the incident and doing their risk man and work cover and all of that, all the way through to if it goes to court or if you're reporting it to the police. So they've been individually developed for every facility within every health service across Queensland. So there's a standardised resource. So if somebody goes from, Townsville Hospital working up with Trevor down to the Gold Coast, then they know what to look for and how to find a document that's going to step them through that process. For me, these incidents never happen Monday to Friday, 8 to 4 or 7 to 3 when the nums are around or when nursing directors are around. So I needed it to be, I guess my drive was that it couldn't be a Monday to Friday manager role. Our nums, our nursing directors, they all have so much going on anyway. We needed something in that immediate phase that was meaningful to be able to give to our staff. So, yeah, that's something that we've done here in Queensland.
And Stephanie or any of the other guys, did you want to add anything about the sort of, the debriefing side of this and what you guys do in your workplaces?
So we have an immediate check-in with the manager or the nurse in charge of that clinical area, and they will provide a formal defuse of that area and some psychological first aid. We've got resources like the bed manager or access manager can come if it's after hours. We have an employee assistance program, and they can be called on site at any time. So like I said, there was a code black that actually happened, and we had a debrief on the spot on the same shift. So it had happened at 7:30, and at 9 p.m. that night we had a defuse with psychologists from Converge International, and with the entire team, the security team, the police, and the access manager who was on that night. So that is a great thing to have and to know that's there and can always be used for any of our staff members, we also have the employee assistance program, where people can get sessions per incident that happens in a year, and that can be over the phone if they don't want to go into the hospital or into an office, and it's completely confidential. And we have a great wellbeing team that's just been increased in its EFT that are available as well, and they provide in services and education on psychological first aid. They provide reflective practice in services, watchful support. They help the NUMS. They've done lots of in service of NUMS and clinical managers so that they're able to do that watchful support over that 4-week period after a traumatic event has occurred, because we really want to watch out for post-traumatic stress disorder. So we have a lot of different things that we have available, but support for this type of thing, for our wellbeing, there can always be more. The more the merrier, with the amount of support that we can have for occupational violence and aggression. I mean, it'd be great in the future if we had like wellbeing champions, or, you know, people out on the floor as well, to support people, you know, speaking up for when they're not feeling the greatest, and speaking up for safety and things like that as well.
Brett Williams has just commented, would having access to concise advice on how to identify and respond to the events covered tonight, all on your mobiles, assist, particularly for those staff who are isolated workers or off-site? It's interesting solution. I'm not sure if what you mean, Brett, is you have like a list of the potential things that could happen, and then sort of, you know, like a solution to each of those, or how you sort of respond to them. You might make a lot of money if you come up with that. It's an interesting. Does that exist for any of you guys? Do you know that? Anything like that?
I think you got to be careful of cue card fatigue. You know, if you're carrying around all these different cue cards, and you've got an incident, and you're doing this, and you're doing that, and you're going through it. It's a good. I think if you can get some basic stuff on a card, it'd be really good.
Okay. My next question is: 10 years from now, what changes would you like to see occur? Trevor, what would you like to see occur?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the question that you asked before about how can we reduce the effect of occupational violence on staff, etc. In 10 years' time, I would like to see, I suppose, units that I've worked on in the past where I've felt happy, I've felt safe, and I've thought about what was it about those places that was different. And it was, we had the resources, we had well-trained staff, we had the proper skill mix, we had an understanding of resilience and what a debrief actually means. So all the correct things were in place, and I'm going back probably 20 plus years now. So it existed then. I want to see it exist again. I think we tried to deal with such a big subject without the appropriate resources. And this is worldwide. This isn't just Australia. I'm talking international here, that unless we get the basics right, this is too big to deal with.
I see a lot of you guys are nodding your heads vigorously. Jim, Steph, Leda, did you have anything you wanted to say, what you would like to see from 10 years from now?
I would love to see definitely OV or some sort of awareness be included in nursing education from day one. So from the university or the TAFE component, from wherever people are going. You know, we often sit our AINs, I don't know if they're called AINs everywhere else, but our personal carers or AINs with the, you know, sitting beside the most volatile patient to special them. So I think that we need to make sure that we are doing the right thing for the patient, but also the right thing for the staff as well. And I would love to see legislative powers that adequately support the risk that clinicians and security face.
I think it's an interesting point. Often, you know, the specials who are there with some extremely volatile people, and are often very, they lack the training. Sometimes they're second year nursing students. It's an interesting point that we put our most dangerous patients, the people who have, you know, they're unwell to the point that they can cause serious damage, and we put the most untrained people who are doing everything they, you know, they're doing the best they can, but they're not given the resources to do that. Steph, what would you like to see in 10 years from now? You're silenced.
Sorry. I like that Canada had the individual safety cards on their lanyards. I think that would provide a lot of reassurance for staff, you know, walking around corridors or to the car park or in the lift, those type of things. And we do have, at the moment, we've got portable ones that we can give to people who have, are looking after high-risk patients. But I think in the context that this is becoming quite a big issue, we all need one in the future. I'd love to have more resourcing and money to develop some virtual reality, because I think we can learn through practicing, but we don't really want to put people in that situation out in reality. We want to be able to practice in a safe space. So that would be fantastic. Gosh, there's so many things. I mean, we're quite lucky that we've had our resourcing increases. We now have an occupational violence and aggression consultancy team now, CNCs, that come to Code Greys and offer support to staff and help manage and plan care. So I think we're making good steps. But yeah, I think that in the future, in the next 10 years, it'd be great to see a lot of things happening in the education space.
Interesting comments just come through. Rosalind Callahan has just said, I'd like to see more behaviour of concern and behaviour management nurses available. It's so encouraging to see more of these roles and where they already exist, to see these roles for more visible, to see these roles be more visible and accessible. And she's gone on to say, as a healthcare assistant and nurse, and I've definitely felt like I could have received more training for caring safely for patients with behaviours of concern. It's very encouraging to see more training becoming available for these sorts of staff. And I agree, we need much more training for all staff within the skill mix. Great, great comments, Rosalind. I think it is interesting that that's another thing that I guess through the nurse break I can highlight is there's so many articles on the website, so you should go have a read of them about all the different career options as nurses. So yeah, there is a whole nother area of role as a nurse, and that is what these four lovely people are doing. And some are still clinical, some aren't as clinical, but they're in the strategy and policy, and so there's a whole bunch of interesting careers you can take. So here is another example of that variety in nursing. This conversation has been all doom and gloom, to be honest. So I want to finish two last questions, but what do you guys love about nursing, and why should people still consider nursing as a profession after all of this stuff we've talked about? Jim, we'll start with you.
Nursing's been 35 years of my life, and it's been a brilliant journey. And despite the bad stuff, the doom and gloom stuff, it's enabled me to meet amazing people. It's enabled me to look after some very ill people and see them get better. It's enabled me to, you know, hold people's hands when they've been distressed and crying and upset and dying. And those things are all character building for me, but it just means that I've actually done something for other people. And it's just been totally rewarding for me. And it sounds a cliche and cheesy, but you know, I wouldn't have stopped for 35 years in one industry if I didn't enjoy it.
Trevor.
Yeah, I've got to echo Big Jim's response there and be a bit how can I word it? Contemplative about my career. If I think about the things that I've really enjoyed, it's very much like what Jim says, whether it comes from the patient, their loved ones, family members, just somebody saying thanks for helping when they haven't been able to. It's just so rewarding. I remember one particular letter from a mother of a very disturbed young man who's in the prison system, ended up insecure, was extremely unwell, and she wrote this letter, and I had to keep it. We ended up framing it and putting it on the unit, but it just meant so much. It's better than the pat on the back from the boss. It's better than the weird rise, etc., when it's heartfelt. And if it wasn't for what we did, who knows what would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks for sharing. Lisa, what do you love about being a nurse? And why should people
do it? I fell into nursing completely by accident. So I didn't come in with, you know, preconceived ideas, but from the minute I started nursing, I just loved it. I think there is nothing more humbling and special than being able to, you know, help bring a baby into a world and also on the same day, you know, make a patient comfortable as they take their last breath. I think there is a truly special and very humbling profession to be involved in. And you spoke a minute ago about, you know, really unique nursing trajectories. You know, no one in my immediate area had ever been down an OV path as a nurse, and so, you know, I copped a lot for it, and was very, very clearly told that it was not a nursing role. But for me, I am so, so privileged to be able to advocate for 120,000, you know, staff in Queensland Health. So for me, I work with the most incredibly dedicated and professional team, and I'm just so lucky to be able to advocate for frontline clinicians now.
That was amazing. And Steph, lucky at last.
Remember to unmute myself this time. when I first started in Mocha, my manager at the time actually closed the door on me as I was walking in to tell them that I got the position, because they were so sad to see me go. And I still do work clinically up until I just had my baby recently. So I do, you know, still keep in the nursing field. So, but I just have a strong passion for safety for healthcare workers, and I haven't ever regretted coming into this field. It's just a huge passion of mine. I look back at my years when I was nursing a lot more, and I loved every bit of it. It was exciting. You get an adrenaline rush because you're running around trying to get everything done with your time management. You get to go and be a part of a patient's journey and their healthcare journey. I remember a patient who he had a traumatic injury to his leg and he couldn't walk. So I helped organise a wedding and I wheeled him down the aisle because he didn't have a best man because they were interstate. So I wheeled him down the chapel and he got married. And then that shift went, ate some wedding cake for my dinner that day. So it's a very exciting job where you're, you know, using your mind and clinically quite active, but also personally you get to create these interpersonal relationships with people that you would never get in any other career. So I've loved my career so far, but I'm just starting and continuing my journey compared to some of you who've been in this career for 35 years. But it's an awesome job.
And for me, 2 years. thanks, guys, for joining tonight. It's been amazing. And I hope there's probably been a few hundred people who have watched this so far. There's still like quite a few who are live with us an hour and 28 minutes into it. So thanks for that. Maybe our guests might, in their spare time later or tomorrow or whatever, go through the comments and maybe just answer any that if they have time, and they probably don't. But once again, thanks for watching, guys, and everyone who's listening to this as the podcast in the future. Thank you again. You can read about all there's. So go to the www.thenursebreak.org, and there's hundreds of Q&A articles with nurses from every field you can imagine, fields you didn't know existed, in written form. And then go to the Nurse Break website and go to podcast video, and you can find the links to all our previous live Q&As like this one. There's been some amazing ones. There's going to be a bit of a gap for the next few months. This is probably the last one. Potentially there's going to be one from an Auslan, so sign language instructor, next week. I'm going to be doing a session for nurses An interesting sort of relates to this, I guess. People who can't communicate and they can only communicate through sign language. That's another unmet need, communication, as simple as that. So we've got an educator who will do a basic introduction to Auslan for nurses and will go from there and maybe make it a bit more complex. So I do suggest you get onto that one when you see it on the Facebook page. Finally, make sure to subscribe, because next Monday, our mini series, the 10-minute video on violence in nursing, is going to be released. And for everyone who's watching, there's a few of you, I'm going to give you a little 15-20 second snippet of it, of the 10-minute video from an amazing nurse. Her name is Nikki, and she's an emergency nurse, and she's eloquently well spoken. And I think we'll then end it there. But did you guys have any final words, takeaway messages you wanted to say? Oh, I think we've said it all.
Just stay safe.
Yeah, stay safe.
Thanks, guys. If you just wanted to stay in the back end after, then we can have a quick chat. And for everyone else who's going to stay watching, you get a little sneak peek. So bear with me while I figure out how to use technology. And it should work any second now.
I work in emergency department, so I think it's one of the areas where we are exposed to a lot of violence, and it was really confronting when I started nursing, and it's not something you really get used to, but it amazes me how people can behave and how they can react, and you do get things thrown at you and sworn at and spat at. Like, I can't, my one thing I cannot stand is people spitting, but you do, and it's so confronting, and it amazes me that people can behave that way towards fellow human beings. I would personally would never speak to someone the way they just speak to them, let alone spitting and kicking and throwing, and the verbal abuse is mind-blowing.
We'll leave it there. Did you guys, were you able to watch that? Could you hear all that?
Yeah.
Perfect. So yeah, that's an amazing 10-minute video from a whole bunch of nurses. And then obviously after that, there's going to be a whole bunch of other videos, because we asked 30 questions and that was only one of them. What is your relationship with violence? So yeah, once again, thank you guys for watching, and make sure to like, subscribe, share, and head to the website.
Jack, I think you're doing some great stuff on this podcast. And I think this violence and aggression video is amazing, because we've got some stuff in Victoria going on from the government. It's good and bad in some places, but anything that raises the profile. So thanks for this, mate.
You're welcome. I might just get, just for those who are watching after, how can people get in contact with each of you?
I'm happy to put my email address in the chat bar if I know how to do it. I don't know how to do it, though.
Oh, we can do that after, yep.
Yep.
And you've got... Yeah. Maybe just do that if you'd like. Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much, guys.
Cheers.
See you soon. Nice to meet you, Steph.